What's up, everybody? Welcome to Kings and Priests. Dean, how are you?
Phenomenal. Had a massive, like, thunderstorm roll through at about 4 a.m., which was exciting.
Man, I missed. That's just, we don't get those in LA.
That's the thing, right? Like, so here in good old Utah, it's a thing in the summer.
Yeah. Is it, I guess it's warm, huh? Are you golfing?
I am golfing. Yeah. Not as much as I want. I'm working too hard, but
good.
Yeah. I sneak in a Friday afternoon round, you know, and a Sunday after church round.
There you go. I was with somebody. I played Sunday afternoon a couple of weeks ago at this place in Glendale, and I got matched with the guy, and he hit a hole in one. It was my first time I've ever seen somebody with a hole in one. And I guess it's his second time to get a hole in one on that same hole.
Oh, wow.
Because he plays this course like all the time. And
is that the one up in the top of the hills? Like in the top?
Yeah. Yeah, it's Shoal Canyon. So it's just like, it's a mostly par three. They've got like four or five par fours. And he plays there like, I think he said like six times a week because he lives half a mile from there. And so he like wasn't near as excited as I thought. Like, I think I was more excited than he was.
I had one at the end of last year and it was my second one. And of course I was super happy, but the guy, I was playing with this guy and he's a big dude. He literally chest bumps me nearly off a cliff. So he was really pumped.
Yep. Yeah, man. Okay. So just because I feel like we've been talking about it for a second each episode. So LIV Golf has added even more, Brooks Koepka is on board. And
yeah, dude, Bryson.
If you
look at the Twitter, you know, feed, there's so much hate for the LIV golfers. And
I know, right? It's like my father-in-law is like a golf purist. And so I sent him a text like, how excited are you? And he was like, that's a boycott from me. Absolutely not. And I'm like, so I was like, well, but the money. And he was like, you don't play golf for the money. And I'm like, yeah, okay. Uh-oh. Okay. I get it.
Really reality.
Yeah.
My favorite like name for it is the Bonesaw Tour, which is not funny, but just a little bit. I'm going to watch it. I'm going to be a fan. So that's what I'm doing.
All right, let's talk today. We're going to go back to a bit of an oldie. This book, Peter Thiel, who I actually have not read a ton about. I'm actually in the middle of reading his autobiography, which is I'm not super far into it, but it's really fascinating. But he kind of really became first known to the greater public, right? He's always been like a Silicon Valley legend, but his sort of coming out party was his book Zero to One, which I remember like buying the audio version of it back years and years ago. And I think just at the time it just, for whatever reason, I was like, this is boring. I'm not going to listen. And then a few years later picked it back up and was like, oh wow, this is massive. So I thought it would be cool if we talked through, a few principles from this book.
Yeah. Love it.
Firstly, why don't you give us just a quick Peter Thiel founded PayPal, one of the PayPal founders.
Part of the PayPal mafia, as it's known, with Elon and David Sachs and others. Mm-hmm. You know, really, if you weren't kind of into software and tech, mm-hmm. you wouldn't have really known him. I think he probably came into broader kind of vision of people when he was, you know, found out to be very conservative and, you know, was and is currently a fundraiser for the Republican Party. So he's a rare conservative in tech, outspoken. He's gay. And so
he funded the lawsuit against Gawker, right?
That he basically shut Gawker down, which good for him. And so like he's just a badass, right? Like on so many levels. And, you know, I guess like there's a lot of things.
He was the first. I didn't know he was the first outside Facebook investor.
Dude,
as well.
Dang. The way he did that, and there's a term that I'm going to botch up here, but he essentially tucked it inside his Roth IRA or something.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's now it's worth like $2 billion and he's going to get
still never pay taxes. Yeah.
I love it. Because at the time it was worth nothing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so obviously, like, you know, you if you're in business, yep, you are going to have to do business with all kinds of people, with all kinds of mm-hmm. beliefs and all kinds of lifestyles. And, you know, I remember, I think we chatted, you know, talking with this guy who wants to build some software for church. And he's like, but I only want to, like, he's a real purist kind of mm-hmm. particular mm-hmm. style of church guy. And he's like, I want yep. to sell to these churches. Like, well, that's about 4% of the market. So unless you get a little broader in who you want to sell to, you're going to have a tough mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, if you're selling things, you're going to be in business and do business with people who have different beliefs than you.
Yep.
And, you know, that's just the big bad reality yep. of if you're going to go to market. And so, you know, whilst I may not agree with all of Peter Thiel's, you know, kind of lifestyle choices and yep. beliefs and everything, you can make, I remember actually it was Pastor Phil that said, make every person your teacher. Like, you can learn from everyone. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so I think, you know, when it comes to like legendary business people in, you know, pick a sector, you know, legendary builders, legendary electricians, yeah. legendary software. Like, if someone is really good, like, go and get all the learning mm-hmm. you can from their expertise, mm-hmm. their mistakes, the successes yep. they've had, mm-hmm. and just get a free education. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those.
And he's all over the place in what he's done. So obviously PayPal, he has a yep. massive hedge fund, Clarium Capital. He launched Palantir, which is crazy. Palantir which is just like,
yeah,
you know,
deep,
that talk
dark
about
data.
Deep dark. I didn't know he was a founder of Founders Fund. So I mean, man, he's yep. he is he's not just done. He's not a one hit wonder. Let's just put it that way.
He is sure is not.
Okay, so let's go through some of these principles from his book, Zero to One. So the first one is probably what he's done. I think this is probably what has set him apart more than anything else yep. is bet on a contrarian truth. So he says, answer the following. Yep. What important truth do very few people agree with you on?
Right.
The example here, Steve Jobs bet on the contrarian truth that we didn't need a physical keyboard for smartphones. Almost everyone at the time disagreed with him. So
I disagreed. Like, I was so in love with my BlackBerry that I'm like, I'm never going to a device that doesn't have yep. a keyboard.
Yep.
And then, and I still remember which is the iPhone is 15 years old, I think mm-hmm. yesterday or the day before. Yep. I still remember lining up at the AT&T store at Gwinnett Mall, mm-hmm. just outside of Atlanta, Georgia, 15 yep. years ago, getting my hands on that phone, like lighting it up, and being disappointed by the keyboard. I hated it.
I remember that switch over when all the, and I say this brutal. When the boomers all switched from BlackBerry to iPhone and yep. the texting and the emails, like I remember I had a boss at the time switch from BlackBerry to iPhone yep. and it was like one of the most hilarious switchovers because it took everyone a long time to get used to. But now can you imagine typing on a physical keyboard?
Well, but the contrarian truth was the keyboard, but really the long vision was apps, mm-hmm. right? So you couldn't have an app store that could do the things that apps do now mm-hmm. within that ecosystem of BlackBerry or flip phones or whatever. So mm-hmm. the genius was let's ditch the keyboard, but let's also create a platform where right. you can basically dominate, you know, the landscape. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, look, you know, in my world, you know, when I started thinking about digital giving, that was a fairly contrarian truth, you know, mm-hmm. giving had been 100 years, you know, cash and check, mm-hmm. Certainly in the US. And so the idea of moving that to a digital platform was, yeah. you know, at the time, a little bit mm-hmm. contrarian.
Well, and contrarian on a church side, but also probably the congregation side, right? Like, congregation is giving cash and check and go, wait a minute, now I'm putting my credit card information in, your auto Boom. Withdrawing my tithe. You know, it's a right. totally different way of thinking.
And, you know, like the pushback from the church was, I'm not going to pay 3%, you know, to get digital gifts. And people aren't going to use their credit card to tithe, right? Mm-hmm. $2 billion. Like, you know, I think we're at yeah. the five, we're now fifth billion, you know, of digital giving in the last 7 years. We'll do nearly 2 billion this year. But yeah, it's that they, that is definitely a thing.
Wait, let's stop for a second. So you're at your 5th billion 7 years, 7 years in, and you're going to do 2 billion this year. So in 1 year, you're doing, what's that around? I'm terrible at math. Let's say 30, 35% of what you've done over the course of your whole company. That's exponential. That's like an exponential.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the awesome thing, right? You know, when you get a customer, a church, you know, they might get 10 or 20% giving digitally, and then every year it just keeps going up. So it's kind of that vibe.
Yeah.
But yeah, the whole idea of, you know, this doing things that people disagree with you on, usually there's something in there for you to go to discover, for sure.
Okay, number two, escape competition. Thiel said, all failed companies are the same. They failed to escape competition. By betting your business on a contrarian truth, you'll dramatically increase the odds of avoiding competition. Make sure to bet on a contrarian truth whose time has come. So that's interesting. If your company or if your thesis of what you're building is that of a contrarian point of view, maybe especially at the beginning, you don't have as much competition. But once people start to realize, oh, wow, I'm onto something, the race then begins for competitors, right?
Yeah. In our case, and I'm just using my, you know, situation because I know it well and what we did. And it's funny, like I read these questions, like how did that apply to me and my company? And I think our escape competition is we went down market to small, medium, and all of our competition went to enterprise, large church.
I remember you probably don't even remember this. I remember sitting in a coffee shop, Dinosaur Coffee, with you on Sunset Boulevard.
Okay.
Like you had just started Tithely. And I remember going like, oh, and you could go this route and this route and this person. And you were like, well, yeah, but what I'm actually betting on is that for every one church of 10,000 people, there's hundreds of churches that reach exponentially more people, which was super contrary because it wasn't necessarily the glamorous way of growth.
It was
at the beginning,
not the glamorous, right? You wanted the big name church. But I'd learned from things like Salesforce. When Salesforce launched, so famously, you know, they kind of, the team broke out of Oracle, which is enterprise, you know, heavy lifting software.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they went to the small, like sign up in 5 minutes, you know, get your little kind of piece of software going. And here's the other thing I knew just intrinsically about the church world is the average size church in America is under 150. So I knew that the vast majority of the 350,000 churches in America, my TAM, were in this small, medium bucket, you know, definitely, you know, 85% being under 500. So, but the hard thing about small, medium, you know, we call it SMB in the software business, small, medium businesses, could be dry cleaners, could be whatever, is it's very hard to build stuff for them to adopt at scale. Because an enterprise sale, I get on the phone and I talk to the CFO or the CIO and I go and sell this, you know, software that costs, you know, 50 grand. In the small medium, I got to price it to be, and we priced it free. So that was helpful. We gave away the software and just, you know, monetize the payment. We even lowered the payment by allowing the donor to cover the fees, you know, a couple of years in. But, you know, essentially, if you can scale small medium, which means add in like hundreds of customers every month by them literally doing the sign on themselves rather than me going to you. And so that was kind of the secret sauce of all
that. And so even to drill down further into that too, right? Like, so if you're thinking small to medium sized in your context, churches versus a massive church, right? So small to medium size, they can pivot faster. There's not as much red tape. It's probably just one, maybe two people that need to adopt this new tool instead of having to go, gosh, I got to get my whole team involved. I've got to get, you know, it's like, there's that, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Nimble.
Just bureaucracy.
Like, yeah. Was that something that you thought of early on as well? Like, hey, I just think it's going to be quicker getting these types of churches involved, right?
Yeah, we just sold one product. It was basically a giving link that you could put on your website and you could be up and live in 5 minutes. So once you solve that, then you get mass adoption, you know, and we're approaching 40,000 customers, the vast majority or, you know, under 500 member churches.
What would you say, if you feel comfortable, your competition, and that could be a number of just dozens of companies that probably would be considered competition, that maybe went a different direction and was maybe the reason that you guys grew faster? Like, what were some, like, what was the opposite way of thinking than what you guys had earlier?
I mean, my thesis was that there's only so many mega churches, right? Call it 2,000 plus or 5,000 plus. So there's only so many of those. And eventually those guys are going to adopt first. So if you look at the landscape, you know, we're seven. Digital giving in a kind of this kind of new way is really 7, 8, 9 years old. And all those guys are done. So the only movement in the enterprise level is going to be people switching, right? And that's just a zero-sum game. Now, as it turns out, the software we built is so good for small medium. We have a lot of enterprise churches, using it. We have probably 5 of the top 100 largest churches in America on our platform. Never had a sales call, never tried to hunt them down. It's just been through a relationship. And but knowing that was going to run out quickly, and that the long tail, right, is going to be these small guys, those country Methodist church or Baptist church. So COVID hits, right, big acceleration for our business. But still today, this week, you know, we'll say, hey, why did you sign up? Well, we thought we should get a giving button and maybe get a website, right? Mm-hmm. Well, there's tens of thousands of those customers still to go get. And our competitors can't go down market because of the cost structure of how they sell.
Right. Their whole infrastructure has to have a certain size of church that does a certain amount a year in revenue to justify. Yep.
That could pay, you know, $500 or $1,000 a month for a giving platform that we give away for free. Mm-hmm. So they can't monetize to the small guy, whereas we built from the ground up. And now, but guess, like, so we can dominate the small medium, which is our probably 90% of our focus still. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we can go upscale because we keep building great software.
Yeah.
And you know, go attack it that way. So the contrarian thing, and you know, you're talking about moats, right? Like, how do I get a moat? Like this, you know, idea of like escaping competition. How do I put a moat around my castle to where the competitors can't come in and take my castle? And, you know, cost structure, you know, how you onboard customers is you know, really been a moat for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Number 3 is start by dominating a small market. When Jeff Bezos started as Amazon, he had the idea of creating an everything store. But instead, he didn't start with everything. He focused on dominating a small niche market, online books. So don't get 1% of a $1 billion market. Get 80% of a $1 million market.
Right. Yeah, that's a hard one because you want to build, like, you want to go for the everything.
Yep.
And, you know, the old saying, crawl, walk, run is very true in building a business. And when it comes to, you know, picking something that you can really go and win in, we had one product, which was a giving form, either on a phone or a computer, that could take a donation.
Yep.
And it was suited for that smaller customer. So, you know, and then later we added, you know, CRM, like CHMS for churches, and we do websites. All the stuff we do now, it didn't start with that. And if we'd have waited to build everything, right, we'd have missed the boat. So we had one thing selling to one particular kind of customer. And we really spent the first 3-4 years just focusing on that. And then we grew as a business, and we acquired some technology, and we built some technology to, you know, build out the suite. But you don't start there. And that's definitely true. It's a temptation that most founders have to resist by trying to build the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Like, just build the first thing that works. And it doesn't even have to be perfect. Like, get your minimum viable product, get it out there, get going, ship stuff, and then get traction, get customers, get revenue, go from there.
Literally, I read this, and then as you were talking, I literally wrote a note down in my phone about something for Vast that has been like this peripheral thing that I think is really necessary to add. And I literally just made myself a note that said, just punt that 90 days and don't even think about it again. Until you get, this. And that's, it's because literally the pressure is so there to want to do a little bit of everything. Yep. Yeah, totally. Okay, strive to be a monopoly. When you establish a monopoly, you prevent the competition from eating away your profit. So they use four examples here: brand association, which is Apple, which is probably the hardest. You know, that's building a brand.
Well,
everyone wants to
time,
build
right?
a brand, but it's really, really hard. Yeah. Proprietary technology, Google over Bing, which is funny. I say Bing. Most people, if you're under probably 30, you've never even heard of Bing. They were my first client working in media and advertising. They were spending, I think they were spending about $250 million in the first 2 years just in marketing. And they don't even... I mean, I don't even know that they exist anymore, right?
They do, but we do a pretty big ad spend, and the vast majority of it goes to Google.
Yeah, not Bing, right?
A little bit goes to Bing.
Yeah. Network effects, TikTok, and then economies of scale, Amazon. So the idea here is, you know, monopoly. What are your thoughts on that? And then...
So brand takes time, right? Mm-hmm. So, and we kind of went with a highly customer-centric focused kind of, you know, software business to churches. So, you know, we have a pretty good brand in the industry. You know, we are well respected, which leads to the network effect a bit, because, you know, you start getting kind of economies of scale of customers, and they all, you know, the customer that we sell to a church, like the pastors are at conferences, they're the most networked people on the planet. Right? Talk about a network effect. Mm-hmm. And so you go and see your product, you know, at a conference and text give by this, and Tidely comes up and blah, blah, blah. So I think those two are a little bit connected. Proprietary technology is really hard. But you can stack stuff up on, so payments, I knew very quickly early were going to be a commodity. It was going to be a race to the bottom on price as far as transacting a payment online, right?
Yep.
But you can build proprietary software on top of that differentiates you, that gives you, you know, some kind of standout feature. But that's a really hard thing to do. And then the economies of scale is obvious. Like once you get traction, the flywheel's going, you start to be able to do things at scale that you couldn't do when you're small. So, you know, Amazon, once they became the king of books, man, it was, you know, was it CDs, right? They kind of went, I felt like they went music. Mm-hmm. And then it was just an onslaught.
And it just, and now it's literally everything. I always say I serviced an agency one time that did a lot of their media buying, and they used to say that anytime they would meet with the team from Amazon, the team would remind the agency, our goal is that every person in the world could get anything delivered to them in under 1 hour. That's
awesome.
Crazy. And so, I mean,
with
like
one
that's,
click.
That's insane to me.
I know.
But that's that. They've built out that that infrastructure to be able to do it. So, okay, five, learn to go from zero to one. Going from zero to one means doing something that has never been done before. It's easy to copy and improve existing products and services. Going from zero to one is determined by original thinking. I read that, and that just sounds... on the surface, really intimidating because it sounds most business ideas are, hey, how do I copy, improve this? Or how do I do the Uber for X, Y, or Z, right? How do I do the Airbnb for X, Y, or Z? But this is really saying like, what's the original thought
that you got to take
from zero to one?
The couple that you just mentioned, right? So, you know, have you watched the dramatization of, the show, about Uber and the one on WeWork, and, Uber one's fascinating.
Yep.
Just the opposition from the limousine and taxi companies, right? Mm-hmm. Globally.
Oh yeah.
Right. The genius of being able to stand in a spot and get a car in 5 minutes was, you know, just a revolution. Mm-hmm. But here's how I think of that. There's always more ideas that haven't been thought up. And if you think, oh, everything's, you know, invented, that's always going to be invented. Like, who was the guy that said that, you know, in 1910 or something, you know, like it's like there is so much more, and technology just keeps allowing us to think outside the box and come up with new things. I think it has to be the mind of an entrepreneur is the mind of a problem solver. Mm-hmm. And so all you've got to do to innovate is find problems and go fix them. And the world has a million problems. So if you're trying to get an idea for a business, look for problems to solve, and that's where your business is probably going to start.
Great. Yeah, that's great. Number six, focus on one thing. Put your effort behind one unique idea. This is something we talk about a lot, but having definite optimism will keep you moving in a positive direction despite failure and setbacks. And I think we talk about this a lot, but it is that. And just what you said, what is that one? What's the one problem? Solve one problem and then start to solve the other ones. But the zero to one thinking is what's one problem that I can I can solve. Number seven, we've done a bunch of episodes about, but we love learn how to sell. People often say, I'm never going to be in sales, yet it is fundamental for influencing others and garnering trust. Sales skills are life skills. And that's,
I love that. Because, you know, we've talked about this, like if you're in business, man, you're a salesperson. Mm-hmm. And if you're not, you're dead. Mm-hmm. And a salesperson is not like you think they are.
Right.
Like you can't think car lot and being talked into getting a car you can't afford.
Boiler room, stockbroker, cold call. Yeah, that's not what we're talking about. Yeah.
It's Wolf of Wall Street, like all that mess. That is not what sales is. In my mind, as a founder, entrepreneur, someone even working in a company that I respect and love and feel on mission with, it's me communicating the benefits of whatever it is I'm selling and being so passionate and like living inside of that product so much. Every time I talk about it, what comes out of me is my enthusiasm for whatever it is I'm, you know, presenting to a to a customer. Mm. And I don't even have to try to sell. Like I'm not, you know, there's the pitch, there's the close, there's the sign here, there's all the old school, like this is what a sale is. Mm-hmm. I think culturally where we're at and millennial, like everyone's skeptical about everything now. That's the old way of selling isn't how you should think when we say sales. Mm-hmm. Sales is enthusiasm and passion for whatever it is you're presenting to people in whatever, you know, medium, whether it be social, whether it be in person, whether it be via Zoom, like whatever it is, you're just pumped about the thing that you're representing and really they're just going to catch it. And they're like, I got to have this. This guy, subconsciously, they're saying, this guy's just given me five reasons why I absolutely need this product. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if there's a go sign up here, fine. But really, you don't even need to do that. Just point them in the direction.
Right.
And they're going to go get it. Mm-hmm. That's what sales, modern sales is to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. Number eight, I love this one. There is no formula. The paradox of teaching entrepreneurship is that a formula for innovation can't exist. Every new innovation is unique. No authority can prescribe in concrete terms how to be more innovative. Think about business from first principles instead of formulas. Here's why I love this, and then I want you to, you know, give your thoughts. There is like no shortage, and I'm seeing it more, especially since my business is content. And so I'm always like studying and looking and seeing what's out there. The amount of like formulaic, I went from zero online sales to 100,000 a month. Here's 10 ways that I did it. And, you know, and it's like all of that is great and fine and whatever. Most of those people are just trying to sell their content. But the people that I've been around that are true innovators and entrepreneurs, up until a certain point, I've been going, what are they doing? Like, what? There's no formula here. They're throwing stuff up against the wall. They're super focused. They're trying. There's no formula. And I think that's the big thing, right? Is like, I think my generation wants a formula for how to be a founder, how to start a business, how to get my freedom to do what it is. And, and man, I don't know. I think the more I'm doing what I'm doing now, the more I'm learning. Yeah, there is no formula. It really is just about waking up every day, putting one foot in front of the other and kind of being willing to do whatever it takes. Right. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on that formula versus just, you know, principle, I suppose. Because there are principles, right? But
Yeah, I think those are different. So like back in the church world where I used to live, which I still do, but on a different side, there was always a church growth thing. There was about one of them a year. Mm-hmm. Right. And there was some guy that grew his church from, you know, he took over this 100-member dead church and now it's 10,000. Mm-hmm. And here's the formula. It's the Lord's Prayer. It's cell groups. It's this. It's
purpose-driven. The whole thing.
It's purpose-driven.
Yeah.
It's growth track. It's like, right?
So, whatever it is.
And then what happens is desperate church leaders grab you know, it's worship. It's this, it's the spirit. It's people falling down. It's laughing. It's like go back
gold
to
the, dust, the last, gold dust falling from the falling dust, from the ceiling.
Right. It's angel feathers. It's
yeah.
So, and I'm not disparaging all of those things, but yeah. What I'm saying is don't look, my church never grew because I went and adopted some other guy's, what God was doing on him. Mm-hmm. It, you know, you could take elements, you take best practices, you obviously do right things right and you don't do mm-hmm. the wrong things. But, you know, in the sense when, like, and I guess on a business level, the extreme of this is, you know, move fast and break things, right? That was Zuckerberg's mm-hmm. thing, right? Like, mm-hmm. there's no formulas. It was like, here's an idea, let's go as fast as we can, bust whatever we got to bust, and let's win. Mm-hmm. I'm not a full proponent of that kind of thing. But, That's the essence of what we're talking about. You just got to get moving. If you hit a wall, you got to be a pinball machine. Like mm-hmm. you got to be the ball that's literally bouncing off stuff until you get in the slot, you know, mm-hmm. And then boom, there's kind of velocity and all of a sudden there's fuel for this thing. This rocket starts going, but until the rocket goes, you're just going. Mm-hmm. And I 100% agree with this. You just got to get moving, make mistakes, get going. Always be polite and kind and treat people well and never burn a bridge and all those kind mm-hmm. of things that we believe. But got to get moving.
Yeah, because when we're I love that analogy of the pinball, because if you're focused on a mm-hmm. formula and you're running the playbook, but the plays aren't working, that's when you get discouraged and frustrated and like, what am I doing? But there is something about like, man, I'm just going to do this and I'm going to, that pinball analogy is great because you just keep bouncing around until you hit that. Yeah. That's exactly what it feels like. Yep. Number nine, learn lessons from the past. Four big lessons from the .com crash that still guide business thinking today. Make incremental advances, which is that crawl, walk, run. Stay lean and flexible.
Love it.
Improve on the competition and then mm-hmm. focus on product, not on sales. That's just learning. And that can be in any context of thinking about situations, successes, failures, and looking at those in the past going, why did this work or not work? And then just being brutally honest with yourself about why it worked, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or didn't work.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The incremental, the lean and flexible, money's expensive right now. If you're raising money to keep your business growing, and all the smart voices are saying conserve cash, pare back, but I kind of live like that. Like mm-hmm. when you run a church for 20 years and you understand that churches are like a cash flow business, that you get mm-hmm. one income opportunity for 90 minutes on a Sunday, mm-hmm. you tend to be good at being able to conserve your cash and be pretty lean. And just iterating and product, that's all incredible mm-hmm. stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay, lastly here, last can be first. It's much better to make the last great development in a specific market and enjoy years or even decades of monopoly profits. So I think the idea here is that you just stay in the game long enough and keep trying, and you certainly don't have to be first. And business history is riddled with the incumbent being just completely
Webvan, which was grocery delivery in the year 2000, to Instacart.
Right.
like Webvan, I can't remember how many billions someone could mm-hmm. look it up, but it's like down the toilet, didn't work because basically the technology wasn't there.
Yep.
And then 20 years later, Instacart comes along and, we literally, when we fly back to California, are ordering the groceries.
Yep.
As we go back. And when we come from the airport, and I've already turned the air conditioning on, and I've done six things mm-hmm. with my phone on the mm-hmm. way back home, maybe fire up the jacuzzi, right? Heat up the pool, do that on the phone.
Ready to, yep.
All right. And then we land and I'm kind of hungry too. So I order Chipotle. And so by the time we get to my door, the Instacart is just arriving. The Chipotle is arriving. It's just awesome.
Yeah. Man, I would, okay, this is, I'll, this is the last, this is, this would be my Instacart / DoorDash / all those rants. It's getting really expensive. And I am going wait a minute, everyone's been doing it. And now there's delivery charge, service charge. Yeah. And next thing you know, a $20 salad is a $45 delivery. But I guess people are still, I guess there's still demand. Otherwise, they would not be making it so expensive to do, right?
That's the thing, right? The market is setting the price. And I would foresee some price pressure on some of that, even if we're in a recession or going into one and people start tightening up. You start tightening up around the edges of your life. That's discretionary. Mm-hmm. And that's the beautiful thing. Those are like food delivery is a great example of, you know, the free market having to work in such a way that, you know, these are, I can have all four apps on my phone and, you know, I can kind of compare. And so there'll be some price pressure there, I think. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the convenience is ridiculous. And it just wasn't there 20 years ago. So you can be last in and dominate
something.
That's
the thing. Yep. Awesome. Well, those are all great. I'll post the link to this in the show notes. 0 to 1 by Peter Thiel is an incredible book that if you are a founder, wannabe founder, is essential reading. The audiobook's really too. So before we close, I think it's been a couple weeks since you and I have chatted for an episode. What's the sentiment out there? Like, you talk to a lot of founders, talk just like macro economy, fundraising, all that. Like, what's just in you know, a minute, where are we at? And has anything changed since we talked last?
It's a tough time to raise money, right? For a brand new startup, not impossible. And if you are continuing to raise money, you better have a plan for that to last 24, maybe 36 months. Because I don't think the economy is going to be bad for that long. And it might not be, like, the labor market is still very tight. We're seeing a little kind of things around the edges, and housing is getting a little pressure with rates. There's going to be another at least 50 point, you know, rate next month, maybe 75 to slap it, that inflation thing in the head. But it's going to be bumpy. So just be frugal and be wise. And there's a whole generation of founders and business people who have only known this to the moon, right? Mm-hmm. And diamond hands forever. And it's going to be a little bumpy. So just be smart, conserve your cash. And if you've got a really good product and serve your customers, you'll do fine. If you've got a crappy product and you don't serve your customers well, you'll probably go away.
Yep.
Like happens in all these cycles. So just button down.
Cool. Good stuff, Dean, as always. Thank you. And we'll see y'all all back here next week.
Thank you. See you, everyone.